Hello, I'm Jo Wood, and I'm so fond of the cycling podcast that I wrote a love letter to it, Awkward. Their blend of intelligence, integrity, and passion greatly enhances my understanding and enjoyment of cycling. Thank you for joining me on countless commutes, training runs, and during my working day when I need to be distracted by some familiar, friendly voices.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freeb.
Hello, Rich.
And Rob Hatch.
Hello, Rich.
In from the cold, Rob Hatch. You haven't joined us for a while, Rob, but you and Daniel are still in Mallorca, aren't you? I can see you there. You look like you've burnt your foreheads, chaps.
No, we don't do that. We put cream on and everything.
You liar. You cannot see us.
No, but Rob just told me that you'd burnt your foreheads. He's more honest, Daniel. Listen,
anyway,
we've got lots to talk about, as per usual. Three sort of big races that we're going to cover in this week's episode and all the talking points arising from them. There's a Tour de Suisse, which we'll cover in the first part. Then the Route du Sud in the second part, which Rob was commentating on for our sponsor Eurosport. And then in the final part, the Women's Tour, won by Lizzie Armitstead. I was there for that, and we will hear from Lizzie Armitstead and from the Barnes sisters, Alice and Hannah. But before we do any of that, we should pass on to the absent Lionel Burney, who is preparing to ride Mont Ventoux, and he's done his usual weekly roundup. So over to you, Lionel.
Hello, Richard. Hello, Daniel. I'm in Bédouin at the moment, in Provence, under the shadow of Mont Ventoux. Although, having said that, the mountain's not casting much of a shadow at the moment. The sun is very high in the sky. It's very warm. I'm actually riding the mountain in the morning. Hopefully be a little bit cooler when we set off first thing. But I'm riding it as part of my research and to record a few bits for a Friends of the Podcast special about Mont Ventoux, which will be coming out in mid-July, just before the Tour de France reaches this part of France. As our friend Simon Gill, our photographer, puts it, I'll be hauling my carcass up to the top of the mountain. Let's hope I make it in reasonable shape. Well, I've just got time to take a few minutes out of my precious relaxation and recovery time to give an update on some of the stuff that's been going on in the world of cycling. It's been a very busy week, so let's start with the Aviva Women's Tour, the latest event in the UCI World Tour Series. It was the world champion Lizzie Armitstead who won overall, putting the seal on her victory by taking the toughest stage of the race in the Peak District. There was also a stage win and a day in the overall lead for Marianne Vos, who continues to work her way back to the top. For the men, all roads currently lead to the Tour de France, and one of the favourites for the Tour, Nairo Quintana, continued his preparation by winning the Route du Sud in and around the Pyrenees. He launched a surprise attack right at the start of the opening stage, breaking away with AG2R's Quentin Jauregui. They gained 11 minutes at one stage, but were eventually reeled in before Brian Coquard won the sprint. Quintana said afterwards, it was some good training and we had some fun too. It sounds like he is building up perfectly for the Tour, because that victory means that he's finished on the podium in all five of the stage races he's done this year, and he's won three of them in Catalonia, Romandy, and now the Route du Sud. The Tour de Suisse was won by another Colombian. Astana's Miguel Angel Lopez Moreno took victory there ahead of Movistar's Jon Izaguirre and Giant Alpecin's Warren Barguil. In the latter part of the race, there was a stage win for Darwin Atapuma, yet another Colombian. Atapuma, remember, came very close a couple of times in the Giro last month. America's TJ Van Garderen won the mammoth 224-kilometre stage to Rettenbachferner in Austria, and Jarlinson Pantano, another Colombian, he rides for IAM Cycling. Well, he looked good towards the end of the race, winning the final stage, which had been shortened to 57 kilometres because of snow. Elsewhere, Ryan Taramay won the Tour of Slovenia and Sepp van Marck took the Ster ZLM Tour in the Netherlands. In other news, the Danish capital Copenhagen is in line to host the Tour de France Grand Départ sometime around 2019, 20 or 21. And Orica GreenEdge's Simon Yates has been handed a four-month ban for non-intentional use of a banned asthma medicine. The British rider had used terbutaline during Paris-Nice in March, but the UCI accepted that his team doctor had simply failed to apply for a therapeutic use exemption, which would have allowed its use in competition. Anyway, the ban is backdated to the date of the incident, and so he'll miss the Tour de France, but most likely return to racing at the Tour of Poland in mid-July. Wish me luck for Mont Ventoux, and I'll see you chaps just before the Tour de France starts.
So thank you very much, Lionel, for that. That was whispering Lionel Burney. He sounded, I don't know if he's fearful, whether he's anxious ahead of his assault on Mont Ventoux tomorrow, but certainly speaking in very hushed tones there, wasn't he, Daniel?
He was. Very much like the whispering Bob Harris, isn't he?
Whispering Bob Harris, a reference that not everybody will get, but he's an old DJ who does speak in a very similar kind of honey voice as Lionel was nicknamed by the I Am Cycling team during the Giro. They called him in a tweet the honey-voiced Lionel Burney. Obviously, listen to the podcast, which is very nice. Anyway, Lionel's away for a week in France. He'll be back next week. And we'll kick off, shall we, talking about the Tour de Suisse, because it was won by yet another Colombian, Miguel Angel Lopez, while his countryman Nairo Quintana was winning the Route du Sud, which we'll talk about in the next part. Angel Lopez, 22 years old, yet another Colombian. It's an extraordinary generation of Colombians. I mean, there were three Colombian stage wins in the race. Sorry, there were two Colombian stage wins as well, Darwin Atapuma and Jarlinson Pantano for the I Am Cycling team on the final stage. But it is remarkable, the number of great Colombian riders who have just emerged over the last couple of years, and they just keep coming.
It is, Rich, and I harped on during the Giro on numerous occasions about the altitude factor there. I'm sure I've bored everyone with this already this year, about the number of times that the Giro went over 2,000 metres. Tour of Switzerland went over 2,000 metres, I think I said last year, more times, or it was due to, because there was a shortened stage and the final stage was shortened, but it was due to go over 2,000 metres more times than the Tour de France this year. So there were a lot of very high climbs, and the Colombians increasingly seem to come to the fore whenever races go over 2,000 metres. And yeah, you mentioned they're the stage winners. Miguel Angel Lopez was the overall winner. He's followed a very similar path to Nairo Quintana from the same part of Colombia, Boyacá. And you know, won the Tour de l'Avenir. Like, did Quintana? Yeah, Quintana won Tour de l'Avenir. Lopez won Tour de l'Avenir. Was brought over by the same character of slightly dubious repute, Vicente Belda, the former Kelme team manager. He was kind of spotted and brought to Europe by him. And then, shortly before that, Tour de l'Avenir in 2014, Belda brought him to Europe. And then Giuseppe Martinelli, the Astana team manager, was at the Tour de l'Avenir mainly to watch his son, Davide, riding, and spotted Miguel Angel Lopez and snapped him up for Astana. And he's had outstanding results the last couple of years. And it looks very much as though he's going to be, well, a very adequate replacement for Fabio Aru, who will really take on Vincenzo Nibali's mantle when Nibali moves to this Bahrain team. So Lopez will be the sort of second leader, won't he?
Well, he's just signed a new two-year deal, actually, on the back of that result. And they call him the Superman in Colombia because somebody attacked him a few years ago, tried to take his bike off him, even stabbed him in the leg, I think. And he managed to fight them off. And he's been fighting well on the road this year. He won already as early as San Luis, I think it was, the start of the year. He's got this new two-year contract. And as you say, Daniel, I think looking forward, you see that Aru's come to replace Nibali, who's probably leaving at the end of the year. And then if Aru looks for pastures new, I think Lopez is fast going to become the second leader at Astana. And think about maybe ahead to next year, he might even be racing the Giro.
Fantastic wordplay there, Rob. You know, we're reminded of the slickness of a professional commentator. The fought off the attackers, he's fighting them on the road. But no, he is. I mean, he was very aggressive in the race as well, if I can say that. You know, he was in a strong position, but just kept on attacking. The other thing that maybe sets him apart from some of the other Colombians is the time trialing ability. He was second in the time trial on the penultimate day, just ahead of Cancellara, behind Jon Izagirre, the Movistar rider who was on the podium with him in the end, and so was Warren Barguil, his first World Tour podium, and he rode pretty well. But the race was interesting from the point, you know, the guys really expected to shine in that race perhaps were Geraint Thomas and TJ Van Garderen, both of whom it was probably important that they did something to establish their credentials ahead of the Tour de France, especially within Van Garderen's case, Richie Porte riding pretty well recently at Dauphiné. And in Geraint Thomas's case, you know, he is gunning for the number two spot at Team Sky behind Chris Froome. But there's a bit of competition for that with Mikel Landa back as well. So not a great, a very, I mean, Van Garderen won a stage, but he rode a bit like a yo-yo. Geraint Thomas, even worse, you know, he had a really bad final day and fell out of the top 10. And he's not sparkling. You don't know how much the weather had a part to play in that, but not greatly encouraging signs for either of those two.
No, although I would suggest that nothing either of those two riders could have done in Switzerland would have really altered their role in the Tour de France. I don't think BMC Racing were ever going to really fully back either Van Garderen or Port. It was always going to be one or the other. Neither of them is clearly stronger than the other. They've both got big question marks over their heads as far as the Tour de France and three-week racing is concerned. And the same with Thomas. I mean, Thomas realistically was never going to be anything other than an able deputy in the eventuality that something goes wrong with.
But the question is, you know, last year he was on the podium in the Tour of Switzerland and went on to be a very able number two to Froome, and even, you know, was in within a few days of being on the podium or certainly finishing the top five overall at the Tour de France. The question though is now whether he can, you know, turn his form around between now and the Tour, which is just a week away. It's unlikely, is it not?
Yeah, well, I don't know. Is it unlikely? I mean, whatever, whether he does or he doesn't, you know that, you know, he's going to go to the Tour for Sky and he will be important at some point in the race. And also that Sky have enough firepower in the mountains, whether he rides well or he doesn't. I mean, Thomas is a guy who, well, he's usually strong on the flat and in the mountains, so he can be useful on various different terrains. I mean, there was some suggestion in Switzerland that he's lost too much weight and he's concentrating too much on his climbing. That might be a bit more of a worry, because presumably in that case he won't be quite as useful on the flat as well.
Yeah, I would say as well, just to add a bit of balance to that, that he's actually won the biggest race of his career in terms of stage racing this year as well. At Paris-Nice, he fought off Alberto Contador, remember, if we think all the way back towards March. And he's been spent a lot of time in Tenerife at altitude, like a lot of the Sky Tour team did throughout May. Coming back down, obviously we know that it affects people in different ways. Maybe it was just a bad few days for him. I'm not sure, and I think we'll, like everybody who's had a bad week or a bad 2 weeks, we were talking about Matthias Frank earlier on, he's had to pull out with illness as well. And all right, we're not expecting him to win the Tour de France, but he'd be looking for top 10 again. You never know until we get to the Tour. The one difference this year is that middle of the first week, you have to be on it, because we've got the first uphill finish very, very early in the race in the Massif Central. And then we go to the Pyrenees. So thinking about what you were saying there, Rich, about maybe worrying about form, this could be the year where you do have to worry about form a little bit earlier in the race.
He's quite an aggressive, sort of nuggety little character, isn't he? It's like very different from Esteban Chavez, who we saw so prominent, the ever-smiling Esteban Chavez we saw so prominent in the Giro d'Italia. My favourite fact about Miguel Angel Lopez, this came courtesy of a friend of the podcast, Fran Reyes, good a Spanish colleague of ours. You know, Miguel Angel Lopez is obsessed with bullfighting. And his hero, his hero is a famous torador called José Tomás, who is apparently extremely... Well. Is he?
Yeah.
Oh, is he?
José Tomás is very famous, yeah.
Do you want to talk to us more about José Tomás?
I don't like bullfighting. I know nothing about bullfighting, but I've seen him on the news a lot, yeah.
Anyway, Richard, after that very useful digression,
well, maybe,
I think we should...
You know, after Larry Warbas so ably read out a section of Hemingway for our Basque Country report earlier in the year, maybe in a future episode we could have Miguel Angel Lopez reading a bit Hemingway on bullfighting. That'd be
Or just fighting a bull live on the podcast.
I'm not sure that would work on a podcast. We could just tell people that's what he's doing, probably get away with it. But we won't do that. I wanted to mention another friend of the podcast, Joe Dombrowski, who I thought rode an excellent Tour of Switzerland in the service mainly of Andrew Talansky. And Talansky finished fifth overall, decent performance. But Dombrowski was outstanding. He was seemed to be climbing very well. In the audio diary that did for us at the Giro, he did talk a little bit about the challenge of keeping, even topping up your form after a Grand Tour. He finished the Giro a couple of weeks ago, obviously, and spoke about the need to keep training really hard, you know, in that period afterwards in order to keep your form. He's obviously done that. It'd be fascinating to hear from him just what he has done between the Giro and now, but riding really well. And I think, you know, showing that he's a guy who can live with some of the best climbers in the world.
Yeah, I think Darwin Atapuma as well took great advantage of his Giro legs. I think it was they were in a break together as well, weren't they, towards the end of the Giro? Atapuma said 4 days after the Giro, he went to look at the stage that he won in the Tour of Switzerland. So he'd obviously targeted it. He wanted to take... it was the first summit finish, actually, in a place called Cari, which I've never been to. I'm not sure where it is. It looks almost Spanish there, written on the way it's written. I'm not sure where it is. Started in Brig anyway, so it could well be down near the Italian-speaking part or even the Romance-speaking part. I'm not sure, but I digress. Atapuma won a very good stage. It was his first win for a long time, and he dedicated it to his mother, who we all know he sadly lost at the start of the last year at Italia, so just over a year ago. And one note on winners who haven't won for a long, long time. Hadlin Sumpantano, first win in 5 years when he took the final stage that was shortened into to Davos. And one more thing that I've picked up from the Tour of Suisse, watching... Peter Sagan, I think we should give him a mention, shouldn't we? Because he actually broke the stage record last week. He's a winner of 13 stages now in the race's history. I think 12 was the record. He won two back-to-back. I think it was second and third, and led the race for a couple of days as well. So Tour's coming around. Sagan's back in form. And
he's
obviously one to watch.
Out of form? I mean, Sagan's always in form. Well, you can set your clock by Sagan, can't you, really? He's always there physically. There's, you know, he's tactically sometimes a bit awry, but he physically seems to always be there. I think you wanted to say something about Warren Barguil there, Daniel.
Well, I did, Richard.
You're not going to incorrectly state that he's a press officer for a rugby team in the wrong city, like you did with Romain Bardet last week. I know you've got them confused.
That's before. a low blow.
Good job we're not travelling together on the Tour de France. Anyway, it's interesting, the great triumvirate of young Frenchmen who I've also harped on about extensively in the past. It's if you remember the swingometer, and elections are very topical in United Kingdom this week with the EU referendum taking place. But the swingometer was a device that used to be used in Peter Snow on BBC. Was it BBC News? Oh, I'm getting everything wrong. Anyway. It used to be a kind of clock, a sort of pie chart that would chart the various swings from one political party to another. And the three main young Frenchmen who we expected to do very well in the Tour and have been doing well in the last few years in stage races, it kind of is like a swingometer that seems to swing one way and another almost on a weekly basis. You know, one week it's Thibaut Pinot who seems to be the most informed, most popular, the flavour of the month. Then it's Romain Bardet, then it's Warren Barguil. And Warren Barguil had a very good week in Switzerland, didn't he? Well, a good 10 days in Switzerland. He had the leader's jersey for one day, didn't ride the best time trial, but he was fairly satisfied with his time trial, lost the jersey. But the interesting thing for me about these three French men is the contrast in their characters. And, you know, Pinot has spoken in the past about how he is portrayed by the French press as almost a bit of a country bumpkin, whereas Bardet is the intellectual and Barguil is this sort of wet behind the ears homeboy who went to live in Nice and has now moved back to Brittany because it was too suave and urbane, and the Riviera wasn't for him.
We'll hear about some of the challenges he faced in an episode of Kilometre Zero at the Tour de France, won't we?
I think we will. And how he prefers roller skating with his childhood sweetheart in Brittany, and, you know, it's fascinating stuff, isn't
it? Who can blame him? But no, he rode very well, and he is. They all seem to also be on a kind of very steadily improving trajectory. They all seem to be developing in parallel. As you say, Daniel, there are moments where one appears to nudge ahead of the others, but generally speaking, they tend to be progressing at a similar rate. And I guess, you know, having each other, having that competition must be quite good for them. The swingometer is a great idea, though. We might try and do something.
We need to
like
come
that.
With a. Have we you... need to come with a name for it, though, don't we? Like the Wawa Bardo, Bardo, Bardometer or something like that.
Bardometer. Well, we'll work on that.
Eurosport, the home of cycling.
Thank you very much to Eurosport for their continuing sponsorship of the Cycling Podcast. They are showing the national championships in Great Britain this weekend. So they'll be showing the time trial on Thursday and the road race on Sunday. Always been a really good race in recent years, so that should be excellent. They'll be missing the defending champion, Peter Kennock, who's still recovering from a broken collarbone. I was speaking to his agent last week, actually, and I don't think he's a great patient, Peter Kennock, but he'll be back soon enough. And we've got, of course, tonight, Eurosport's Rob Hatch with us. And you were commentating last week, Rob, on the Route du Sud, won by Nairo Quintana, who emerged from weeks of training at altitude back home in Colombia to win a race that had a fairly modest field, didn't it? He won it at a canter, really, didn't he?
He did, yeah. It had a modest field. It was quite a bit disappointing in that respect compared to last year. Of course, last year we had Contador coming out of the Giro that he just won, and he was up against Quintana. He beat him in that race for the title in Route du Sud last year. This year we had 5 stages in 4 days. We had a split stage on the second day. And believe it or not, Nairo Quintana actually decided to go in the breakaway on day one, which was absolutely bizarre. It was great to watch. It was flat ending. It should have been one for the sprinters and was in the end, but Quintana in the break for about 150 kilometres on day one. He picked up a couple of bonus seconds, so was already quite cleverly up near the top of the lead already, and he said it had been about 5 years since he'd been in a breakaway, so he really enjoyed himself.
Rob, but
out
my
there.
Ice cream van just went past.
Is that your ice? I wonder what that sound was. I'm trying to stoically carry on here, and you're ordering a Zoom or a Calippo.
Mr. Whippy.
Do carry on, Rob. Do apologize.
Sorry, wait. Nairo Quintana in the break on day one. It was a sort of eye-opening thing. Everybody looked around and everyone's thinking, no, it's got to be Dyer. They've got the wrong number, because he was racing with his brother, Dyer Quintana. Nairo Quintana out there in the break, putting a really good performance, made a lot of people smile, I think, and he said he wanted to inspire young people around the world and inspire his colleagues to attack races more. So that first stage and the second stage was won by Brian Cooker, of course, friend of the podcast, and he looks in great form. He led after that, and all the action happened on the third stage, really. Nairo Quintana winning the time trial, and winning a time trial for just the second time in his career as a professional. All right, you might say that the start list wasn't great, but he beat Sylvain Chavanel, who was in second place and showing some really good form, a proven time trialist, even though he's in the, let's say, the autumn of his career right now. And Quintana won on what was a relatively flat day. The only other time trial he'd ever won in his career was the mountain time trial when he won the Giro d'Italia to Monte Grappa the other year. So Quintana good. And then on the mountain stage on the Saturday, the big Queen stage where we went over the Tourmalet and some other big mountains in the area, Hugh Carthy was the big bit of news for any British listeners. He would put in a fantastic performance and but for a crash on the final day, inside the final 4 kilometres, I think it was, of the final stage, he would have finished on the podium in third place. In the end, he crashed and he finished 22nd overall, but he came third on that mountain stage, won by young Max Soler, the 22-year-old who won the Tour de l'Avenir last year. A really good climber, likes the long climbs. He's a Catalan rider, just 22, as I said, and there's a little bit of talk in the Spanish press that he might actually make his Grand Tour debut later on this year at the Vuelta. So he's one to watch out for. But in terms of the GC, Nairo Quintana, vastly superior to everybody else and maybe lacking a little bit of competition for everybody to take that as a serious message going into the Tour. I think the big message that we have to take going into the Tour would be that time trial win.
Yeah, it's difficult to know what to make of it. I mean, had he not won, you'd have been worried, I guess, concerned about his form going to the Tour. But it has been interesting, hasn't it? Just the build-up of all the favourites. Most of them were at the Dauphiné, but, you know, all following their own path. And it just it keeps the intrigue certainly alive. You know, you wonder where Quintana is. There are no real benchmarks between Quintana and Froome, for example. So it is fascinating.
But what I would say is that...
Sorry.
Sorry, Rich. What I would say is that he's won 3 stage races already this year. And okay, the Route du Sud is one, but he won the Volta a Catalunya, first Colombian winner there for a long time. And he also won the, actually, first Colombian winner ever, if I think. Don't quote me on that right now, but I'm pretty sure, thinking back, that he was the first Colombian winner of the Volta a Catalunya. And he also won the Tour de Romandie as well, mm-hmm. which was a fantastic win against some of the best riders in the world. So he's beaten the best on a couple of occasions already this year. So I think he's not going to be short of confidence.
You mentioned Marc Soler and the Tour de l'Avenir. Espen Chavez came through Tour de l'Avenir as well. The Tour of the Future, as it's known, it used to be in the old days, a race where future Tour de France winners and Grand Tour winners would announce themselves. It wasn't for a while, but it very much is again, isn't it? And you know, you mentioned Marc Soler going to the Vuelta. Gomez also, I think, is going to the Vuelta, isn't he, for Astana? So it sets up a very interesting Vuelta. But we've got the Tour first, and it's almost upon us. Next week will be our Tour preview episode, where we may unveil our sponsors for the Tour, which we're very excited about. So what do we reckon after the Dauphiné, Tour de Suisse and Route du Sud? What have we learned from these races in terms of the favourites? And you know, if you look in particular at Contador, Froome, Quintana, anybody else belong in the category of favourite for the Tour?
Well, I wouldn't say so, Rich. I mean, coming into the Dauphiné, you might have wondered whether Fabio Aru would encroach upon the sort of Galacticos. We have included Vincenzo Nibali in that conversation before, the four Galacticos: Quintana, Contador, Froome, Nibali. Nibali certainly haven't ridden the Giro. Won the Giro, but not been entirely convincing. You would be surprised if Nibali was going to threaten Froome, Contador and Quintana. He certainly said that he's going in there to help Fabio Aru, and Aru himself, he flattered to deceive really for most of the Dauphiné, and then pulled out that amazing stage win, which was a breakaway stage win on a relatively flat day. So I can't really see those guys being threatened. I think that we mentioned the French riders. I think the three French riders we mentioned, Barguil, Bardet and Pinot, will ride a very good tour and be on the edges of the podium, on the sort of fringes of the battle for the yellow jersey. But I don't think they will all necessarily be contenders. I don't think they're quite strong enough to all be reliable as contenders at the tour yet. But I think Bardet, based on the Dauphiné, is the rider who will cause the main yellow jersey.
Is that a cockerel I can hear?
It is.
We're in the middle of nature. It's beautiful. Lemon trees, orange trees. Next door's dog. Everything.
I've got an ice cream van. You've got a cockerel. I should have said that you're in Mallorca, of course, still, aren't you? You pair.
We are. Anyway, Richard, going back to what I was saying, I think that Bardet will be the most dangerous, just based on the tactics he's employed in races so far this year, just his ambition. I think he's the most ambitious of those three riders. I think he doesn't necessarily have the best team of those three riders, but I think he has.
He's got a pretty decent team, though, hasn't he?
Well, yeah, and I think they're the most aggressive team as well, who have shown in the past two or three Tours de France that they know how to race aggressively. They know how to execute a plan in the mountains. So, you also look at the stages in the final week of the Tour de France, and I think the big feature of this year's Tour is going to be the short stages in the final week, the sort of 150, 180 kilometre mountain stages, starting right from stage 15 that goes to Culoz on the, what's in the Jura, but it's the edge of the Alps, and with a lot of descending. We know that Bardet is an exceptional descender, and there are a lot of places there, and I also think that Contador might be in a position where he needs to pull something out of the hat there. I think there's a lot that could happen on those
Anarchy.
Stages. I think that AG2R will be central to that.
He's got a lot of local knowledge there as well. Exi Vuillamos, I think, is from the Jura as well, so he'll certainly have had Romain Bardet around for a bit of training, and they'll know the roads, they'll have recon stages, and I think there'll be a really, really well.
Oh my, what the heck are you
dog
on a farm
talking
yard
about?
Or what's going on?
I think I've upset Nectar's dog.
What kind of animal are we going to hear next?
We've got a pregnant cat, we've got a goat, we've got a cockerel. We've got a dog. Yeah, you hear the cockerel there again? That was very apt, wasn't it?
Just as we said.
We've been talking about Brian Cocker.
And the young Frenchman. Every time we mention a young Frenchman,
sorry,
the cockerel.
About
anyway.
This.
Where were we? Yeah, the juror. And Alexis Vuillermoz, I think, is going to have quite a lot of local knowledge for Romain Bardet on that day, I think. So Aje Dessert will be a team to look out for on that day.
Yeah, well, we can indulge in all this speculation, can't we, without Lionel here? But Bardet does seem strongest in the head, doesn't he? Seems to be the one least prone to sort of the kind of meltdown that we've seen Pinot last year at the Tour, and Barguil, maybe not so much in races, but as you mentioned, Daniel, he, when he went and tried to live the monk-like life in the south of France, he had to,
Barguil has
he
a bit
home.
Barguil, just his style on the bike as well, he has more of the kind of whimsical flaneur about him. He just seems to be, you know, when he attacks, he seems to just be tootling off down the road almost for the fun of it. Bardet is incredibly, he's a kind of the boulevardier of the threesome, is Barguil. But Bardet,
like you the other day when I lent you my bike when I went off to commentate, you were riding
a whimsical flaneur,
so
I would imagine.
Daniel and his new,
that could be a t-shirt,
free cycling invention,
the whimsical flaneur. Daniel, speaking of t-shirts, as the man in charge of the t-shirt department, the cycling podcast, I think the new designs are going to be available next week, is that correct?
They are. But Richard, I was just, if you'll just allow me to finish my whimsical point about the whimsical Frenchman. Bardet is very, very ambitious, and Bardet is kind of upping the ante every year as far as training, as far as technology, you know, this year is concerned. You know, this year he spent more time than ever on the Sierra Nevada in Spain at altitude. And Pinot is not training altitude yet. He's very rare. He's probably unique among Grand Tour contenders at the moment in that he doesn't spend any time at altitude. But yeah, I think Bardet has this kind of really steely-eyed ambition about him. And if he doesn't get there this year, then I think that in the next two or three years, he's going to be a real factor in the Tour de France.
I wonder if his sister will be back in the press room this year. Lisa Bardet is a regular feature there. She works in the press room at the Tour de France. I did mention the t-shirts there, Lionel. Daniel is your name. The new range of t-shirts will be available next week, is that correct?
Yes.
The t-shirts available at cyclingpodcast.com.
Hello, my name is Charlene Joyner and I ride for Team Ford EcoBoost. You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast in association with the Poppy Scotland Sportif. Three rides over some of the most spectacular roads in Scotland on September the 25th. For more information, see poppyscotland.org.uk.
So that was Charlene Joyner, as she said, former Commonwealth Games medalist. I don't know if you're a former Commonwealth Games medalist. You're just a Commonwealth Games medalist, aren't you? She won a medal in Delhi in 2010.
Richard, a former Commonwealth Games participant.
Well, she is.
For the sake of argument.
Self-evidently. And for June, this is our last week promoting and supporting the Poppy Scotland Sportif on the 25th of September. It's a great event on beautiful, quiet roads in East Lothian near Edinburgh. 600 riders this year. There are few places left, so act quickly if you want to ride. It's an unusual one in that all the entry fees go to the charity Poppy Scotland, which supports the Armed Forces community in Scotland. And it's thanks to various partners that that's possible. Fred Olsen Renewables pay the bills. Bramick Foods stock the feeding stations. Leaf Cycles provide mechanics and support. And the Musselburgh Road Cycling Club help out as well on the day. And it's a terrific route through the Lammermuir Hills, which featured in the Tour of Britain last year, some may remember. And there's a 100-mile route this year, as well as two shorter routes, and lots of climbing. I went through the climbing distances last year. So I'm trying to talk Lionel into doing it. Daniel might be a lost cause. No whimsical flaneuring for him in East Lothian in September, but Lionel and I might be up for that. So might see some of you there. poppyscotland.org.uk if you want to ride the Poppy Scotland Sportif. Now, in this final part of the podcast, I want to talk about the Women's Tour, because I was there last week.
I noticed you were there, Richard. It looked like a cracking race, cracking week.
It really was. It grows every year, and, you know, it started pretty well, and it just gets bigger every year. The crowds, the teams are better, more professional. It's a difficult race to cover as a journalist because there's no live TV coverage, and I think that's one of the aims. Another of the aims is to go from 5 days to 7 days, as Guy Elliott, who is the race organizer for Sweet Spot, told us in last week's first ever cycling podcast, Femina, which was broadcast last week, and there's quite a bit in there about the women's tour and the plan to go to 7 days. But I was lucky enough on day three, which was the hardest stage, the Queen's stage, or maybe the King's stage, seeing it's a women's race, I don't know. So I was just standing at the point in the climb, coming out of Matlock Village, where Lizzie Armistead countered behind that breakaway with Ashley Moolman-Passio, the South African rider, and Elisa Longo Borghini, and those three really were the strongest three in the race and ended up top three on general classification. But it was fortunate that I was able to watch that decisive moment in the race. And I spoke to Lizzie Armistead after the stage. She won the stage, of course, into Chesterfield. Let's hear what she had to say.
Our plan was very definitely that we'd want a girl in the breakaway and that I would jump across on that climb. And we knew Ashley Moolman would probably be quite aggressive because she has been in previous races and she's got a kick. So we expected her to launch an attack. I didn't expect her to launch it at the bottom, but she did. And I had the perfect lead out from Ellen and Christine right into the bottom of that climb. So I was really well positioned. And I didn't follow Ashley's attack initially because I thought if I follow that acceleration, then I'll blow up. I knew from people's advice that it was a long, steep climb. So I just kind of held them at sort of 20 metres and managed to crawl back up to them and get over the top with them. And then it was a bit of a slog then to get to the breakaway. And when I arrived there, Chantelle, did some work on the front and took us as far as she could. And I attacked then to bring the strongest girls in the race away, really. That was the idea. It's one of the things that I'm quite good at. I don't get caught up in the expectations of people around me. You know, the previous two stages have been kind of sprint stages and people have said, you know, why aren't you sprinting? Well, I've been very clear. I've been working on my climbing and today was a hilly stage and I think that, the legs are in a good place and I'm happy. For me, I didn't expect any good sensations on these roads. You know, you have to just get on with it and attack even if you don't feel great, because you're never going to feel great on this kind of terrain. So I'm not wanting to feel great. I don't want to feel sparkly and aggressive in this race. I just want to feel strong. That's where my phase of training is at the moment, so I'm happy.
So that was Lizzie Armistead. A few interesting comments from her. I mean, she'd already told us that she wasn't expecting too much at the women's tour, having been training throughout May for the Rio Olympics and really working on her climbing. And an interesting comment from there: I didn't want to feel great in the race. I didn't want to feel sparkly and aggressive. I just wanted to feel strong. So she was also ill. Her father revealed that she had been ill in the morning of that stage, but she wasn't too happy to learn that he'd told people that. But she wasn't at her best, and yet she still won, and won very convincingly, really. So it all looks very good for her. I mean, yeah, I had a great few days.
What has changed, particularly with her this year? I mean, she's obviously been one of the best riders in the world for a long time. And, you know, she won the World Championship last year, which was obviously a little bit of a breakthrough. She's been won big races throughout her career. But it really seems that this year her win rate is extraordinary. I mean, she's won almost 50% of the races that she's taken part in this year, and she's really moved into the role, the guise of a sort of cannibal of women's cycling, which was a role previously occupied by the likes of Marianne Vos. I mean, is there anything that's changed? Has the opposition got weaker? Has she got stronger? Is it just confidence? I mean, is there any, and what are the other riders saying about that?
My theory is that you mentioned Marianne Vos, and I think that her problems over the last year have been a big factor in Armistead's improvement and emergence. I think that Vos was a real problem for her. We saw it in 2012 in the Olympic road race, where she came to the finish with Vos and almost seemed to expect to be beaten. And I think she acknowledges now in the interview we did with her in February that she perhaps could and should have played that finish differently, but It was in line with expectations. When coming to the finish with Marianne Vos, she considered the best she could do was second, and she was second, and she was happy. And, you know, Vos continued that dominance, really, for the next couple of years. And then last year, she was diagnosed with, you know, chronic tiredness. She was told she'd been overtraining. She was somebody who raced cyclocross in the winter. In 2013, she was dabbling with mountain biking, and she was even talking about doing the mountain bike race in Rio. And I think she stretched her body too far, and she's now coming back. You know, she was strong at the women's tour, not quite strong enough on the climbs. And I did an interview with her and a lot of people around her for a special little Vos feature in our next cycling podcast, Femina, which will be coming out on the second rest day of the Tour de France, so a few weeks away. But really interesting, because also for Vos, you know, to have been so dominant, and now to you know, speaking to her coach, he wasn't even sure if she was at her old level, whether she would still be winning, because the standard has risen so much. But I think for Armitstead, it's been a case of, you know, gradually growing confidence, because she was very consistent last year. Confidence gradually growing. And I think that the absence of Vos has been a factor too.
And just on the race itself, Rich, I mean, it's become very prominent the last couple of years, the women's tour, and great sponsorship, and, you know, we shouldn't really say great media coverage yet, because, as you say, one of the problems with covering it is the lack of live TV coverage. But in terms of, you know, the hierarchy of prestige in women's cycling and stage races, it falls at a time or in a window in the calendar, which, you know, in June, before what I suppose a couple of years ago certainly traditionally was the most prestigious women's race, which was the Giro d'Italia, in the absence of a women's Tour de France. And again, this year it comes just before the Giro. Did you get any sense of how the women's tour is viewed by the women? Is it still second in terms of prestige and importance to the Giro d'Italia, or has it surpassed that? Will it surpass that?
I think I don't know. I'm not an expert on the women's scene yet. I'm working towards that. But my sense, speaking to the riders, was that it's at least on a par. I think the timing helps it, because the Giro Rosa tends to be overshadowed by the Tour de France, of course. And everything is overshadowed this year, especially by the Olympic Games. But the women's tour, everybody you spoke to said that the crowds are unsurpassed for any event in the world. They're just extraordinary. And, you know, that climb in Matlock was absolutely rammed with people. You know, a mix. They do a great job promoting the event around the schools, so the schools all turn out, and they add a lot in terms of atmosphere. But, you know, club cyclists come out, local people come out. And it's great to see that for, you know, a standalone women's event. You know, it certainly, you know, the finish in Chesterfield the other day was, again, absolutely packed. There was no difference between the women's tour and the men's tour of Britain. I had a chat one morning with Chris Walker, the former British professional whose kids both raced, but Jessie Walker, his daughter, his wife Lynn as well, was a British international back in the day. But his daughter Jessie was riding for Great Britain, and she rides for an Italian professional team based in Turin. And, you know, he was just saying that when his wife Lynn raced, that she used to set off with a couple of other women 10 minutes ahead of the men. You know, that was women's racing back in the 80s. And as he looked around and saw the infrastructure, the crowds, the barriers, the team buses, camper vans and vehicles and staff and the entourage, the podium, you know, everything about it. He said, this is just amazing, the progress that's been made, and that this exists now for women cyclists. And, you know, a very proud father. He was in the car with Guy Elliott that day watching the race, and, you know, he was delighted. I should mention that I also spoke to the Barnes sisters, Hannah and Alice. Let's hear from them, because Alice Barnes has been a real breakthrough talent this year. I've done a couple of interviews with her recently where I've referenced her age as being 19. She's actually 20, and she's almost 21, so apologies for that, Alice. But she's been riding exceptionally well. It was a big step up for the women's tour, riding for her team Drops, which also featured in the cycling podcast Femina last week. an amateur team, and her sister Hannah, who rides for Canyon SRAM. Hannah had 5 months on crutches over the winter and is just sort of still getting back up to her previous level. She won the stage of the women's tour last year. She's not quite back at that level yet. But here is Alice Barnes and then her sister Hannah.
It was a hard race and I was up there all the time, and then on the last QOM there was like a coming together, and I like got caught in it, and I was caught up a bit with like my rear mech and that, so I'm just disappointed I wasn't not in the front group, because I wasn't strong enough. I was there because I got tangled, which is really frustrating. So,
but as we spoke about last week, you know, this is a big step up, isn't it? But I guess now you're here, you feel you've got the legs to be up there with the best women, do you?
Yeah, it's a massive step and it's a great race, but it's just disappointing because I was feeling good and I was in the front group, and then I missed out from misfortune rather than not good legs, so yeah, it's a bit disappointing.
I guess you've been used to winning recently as well, haven't you?
Yeah, obviously I wasn't expecting to win today, but going quite well, so I'm happy with where I am, and hopefully I can prove myself a bit more in the coming days.
What do you feel that sort of riding in the company of some of these riders and teams, do you feel, you know, you're only 19, but do you feel that they're not that far ahead of you?
Oh, it's amazing. It is difficult when you've not got like a massive group of teammates around you, and obviously riding around Lizzie Armstead, Marianne Vos and the likes of those big names is huge, so yeah, it's a really big experience for me.
How are you? Because I last spoke to you at Flesh Wallonne. How have things been since then?
About the same. No, they're all right. It's been a steady progress, I guess. At the start, I saw lots, and now it's just slowly getting there. But no, it's good. I mean, races like this, to be able to be in the mix with the best riders in the world is really great.
And I guess your progress is going to slow down a little bit because you were coming from a long way back, but do you still feel that you're, you know, inching towards, you know, where you were?
I feel there's still a long way to go. I think right now I'm mentally tired just because it was a hard 3-4 months just focused on one thing, so yeah, it's good, and I'm looking forward to the Nationals next week just to see how that goes, and yeah, to the second half of the season, really.
How is it being here in this race? This is a race you've got happy memories of, but what's it like to be back here?
It's really good. I mean, I'm here with a different team, and I quite like having the different role and just getting stuck in. And I'm kind of bringing some of the knowledge. I know some of the roads as well, so I'm able to radio through and just let everyone know what's coming up, which I think they appreciate, and in the team meetings as well. So, yeah.
And your family, are they all here? Because you live quite locally. Well, the family live quite locally now, do they?
I mean, stage 5 is locally, but my mum and dad take the opportunity when we're at home racing, so they've taken the whole week off work to follow it, so I've been seeing them every day.
Cool. I was speaking to Alice there. I mean, you must have been watching her. You'll be looking over your shoulder, are you?
No, it's great. I mean, all my teammates yesterday were like, God, I saw your sister everywhere, and it is really good, but I sometimes don't like her in the race because it's another person to worry about. If you hear a crash behind, I'm like, oh, where is she? But no, it's really good, and it's been great to see her do so well. And
well, it's amazing because I spoke to her last week and she was talking about what a step up this would be.
Yeah.
But speaking to her there, she seemed disappointed today that she wasn't up there. She's obviously feels that she's able and capable of being there.
I mean, on the last GPM, she got tangled up and she was in the front, and she came past me sprinting past, and I was like, I just said, don't panic. But I mean, it was gone. It's just unfortunate. She could have been there, and I think she knows that. But the next 2 or 3 days are going
to
be good.
What does it make you? You know, it must make you feel very proud to see her in this sort of company.
Yeah, it's good. She had different focuses last year, and I think now it's changed the road, and she's debating what to do now. But I've put my little input in.
So you obviously feel very protective of her. Do you think it goes the other way? Does she look out for you as well?
Yeah, she does. I mean, over the winter, she was always asking how I'm going, and yeah, she had to do quite a few things for me, which by the end of it, she was a bit fed up.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Join us on Twitter and Facebook. Just search online for the Cycling Podcast.
So we heard there from Alice Barnes and Hannah Barnes. You had an interesting fact about them, Rob.
Yeah, it's a funny one. They finished actually right next to each other in the overall general classification. Alice Barnes 26th at 5:14 from the win, and Hannah Barnes just 6 seconds later. So it was the drops rider who got the bragging rights in the Barnes household last week.
Oh, difficult. Well, younger sister upstaging her older sister, who is, of course, as we said, recovering from a very nasty injury, and no doubt she'll be back at the top soon. But Alice is certainly destined for there. We should wrap things up.
Also, Richard, well, before you do wrap it up, Richard.
All right.
I was going to mention, we were talking about the Barnes household. I don't even know if they live together, but Hannah's boyfriend, a real friend of the podcast. Sometimes we lie about who is actually a friend of the podcast. We actually suggest that people are friends of the podcast when we have very loose connections with them. But real, genuine, paid-up friend of the podcast, Theo Gegenhart, Hannah's boyfriend, correct?
Well, they live together in Girona, Theo and Hannah.
Well, they live together I was about to mention that Theo has just finished second in one of the most prestigious amateur races on the international calendar, the Tour de Savoie, which is always a race that tends to tell us who is going to be a very successful professional in the years to come. And Theo finished second to a Spanish rider, actually.
Enric Mas.
So
well,
anyway,
you know, point of information, well done, Hannah also is a friend of the podcast, although I'm not sure if she shares Theo's login. We'll have to look into that and put a stop to it if that's what's happening. Anyway, speaking of friends of the podcast, the next Friends special will be out next week. Not this week as originally advertised, but next week. You're beavering away, Daniel, aren't you, on your Operation Puerto special. How's that coming along?
Tremendous.
I'm really looking forward to that. You're going to be reliving that tumultuous day in 2006 on the eve of the Tour de France, the first post-Lance Armstrong Tour de France, where the whole edifice seemed to be crumbling, and that should be a really fascinating episode that will be out next week on the eve of the 2016 Tour.
30th of June 2006, which others will remember was the day of Germany beating Argentina in the 2006 Football World Cup. Germany have just gone 2-0 up tonight in the Euro 2016 match. So, you know.
All right, that's enough. That's definitely time to wrap things up. Thank you very much.
Well, we want to go and watch second half, so yeah, come on.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you've still got a couple of shandies there. I heard you when we were off air there, Daniel asking Rob if he could get my shandy from the fridge. That sounds like quite the life you're leading out there. I've got my 99, you've got your shandy. We're all set. The
problem is, though, being out in Spain, Daniel's working so hard on this Operación Puerto thing that I keep having nightmares thinking that Guardia Civil are going to knock us up in the middle of the night.
Let's not overrate it anyway.
Let's hope that doesn't happen. In the meantime, Rob Hatch, thank you very much.
Muchas gracias.
And Daniel Freeb, thank you.
Thanks, Rich.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.